this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSilicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, May 8th, 2011, and this is show number 311. Well, a while ago, I started the NoSilicast news, and I told you that one of the purposes was to let you know if anything was ever wrong in the podcast, like if my site was down or something dreadful like that. Well, last week in editing the show, I inadvertently moved the jingle track so that it left gaps in the audio file and then had jingles on top of the voice recordings. Normally, Steve does do a sampling of the show instantly after I post it, but his sampling apparently missed the three spots where the error occurred. Luckily, when I awakened at 5:30 a.m. on Monday morning, my early warning system, also known as Connor PJ1 from the East Coast and Mac Topics from Germany, alerted me to the problem. The first thing I did was correct the problem as quickly as I could, and while the file was uploading to the server, I shot out a note in the NoSilicast News to all of the subscribers. So anybody who was subscribed to the NoSilicast News knew about the problem, knew not to download until after the time I gave them. I said, okay, at this time, there'll be a good file, and if you've already downloaded, just delete the feed and re-add it. I was so happy to be able to tell people up front that something was wrong. The additional benefit of having such trustworthy early warners combined with the newsletter meant that I didn't get any other emails or tweets telling me that it was messed up. Usually when something goes wrong like that, I spend the whole day emailing back going, yeah, I know, I screwed it up, here's the blah, blah, blah to fix it. If you haven't signed up for the NoSilicast News yet, just head on over to podfeet.com, look over in the right-hand sidebar for the sign-up form. Thanks again to Connor and Klaus. Last week, Professor Albert asked what the I stands for in all of the Apple products. I did a bunch of Googling and Wikipediaing and came out with some weak sort of half answers. But Adam Herman, also known as This Is Adam H on Twitter, sent me the real definitive answer. I'm so glad because I really hated that I disappointed the professor, you know? He puts me on such a pedestal, I hated to shatter his image of me. Adam sent along a video link to the 1998 Apple keynote. Steve Jobs is up on stage in a dress shirt and jacket announcing the first iMac. Looks kind of weird. Anyway, in the first 30 seconds, he puts up a chart showing what the I stands for in iMac. His chart says Internet, Individual, Instruct, Inform, and Inspire. But let's actually hear it in Steve's words.
Well, today, I'm incredibly pleased to introduce iMac, our consumer product. And iMac comes from the marriage of the excitement of the Internet with the simplicity of Macintosh. Even though this is a full-blooded Macintosh, we are targeting this for the number one use that consumers tell us they want a computer for, which is to get on the Internet simply and fast. And that's what this product is targeted for. I also mean some other things to us. We are a personal computer company, and although this product is born to network, it also is a beautiful standalone product. We're targeting it also for education. They want to buy these, and it's perfect for most of the things they do in instruction. It's perfect for finding tremendous source of information over the Internet, and we hope as you see the product it will inspire us all to make even better products in the future.
So many thanks to Adam for sending in that video and help us to resolve this most important dumb question. Well, last week, Connor P. chatted me up with a question about how I manage photos for my son's track team in the old days. He's struggling with the volume of photos coming in from parents, where to store them, how to present them, on the website he created for his team. Originally, I was the main photographer for my son's track team, taking like 300 to 400 photos at a single meet. You got to understand, there's hundreds of kids on the team, and the meet lasts hours and hours and hours, and there are all these different events, so taking a lot of pictures is not quite as dumb as it sounds. I used JAlbum to create a nice visual experience, and then I would FTP the albums up to the website I created using WordPress. He asked me how I managed the other people taking photos. You can hear the answer already, can't you? I use screen steps to teach them. I did have the advantage that everyone was willing to use a Mac or wanting to use a Mac, so I was able to teach them how to download and install JAlbum, how to export their photos from iPhoto into JAlbum, how to create the albums to the standards we'd chosen, black background, ribbon across the top, and access to reasonably high-res photos so the kids could make them profile pics on Facebook. I taught them how to install the free CyberDuck so they could FTP to the server, and then how to set the page up in WordPress. I created PDFs that I mailed out, had the people over for a one-hour session at my house, modified the instructions easily and quickly in screen steps when they had a little clarifying question here and there, and from then on, they were on their own. That was 2 years ago, and I haven't had a single support call since. If you don't think screen steps is as powerful as I say, try their free trial and prove me wrong. Head on over to screensteps.com and check it out.
Hi, listeners. This is Jans from Frankfurt, talking about running a GTD system in a standard Lotus Notes environment. Lots of people have to live in both worlds, like PC at work and Mac at home. The even poorer of them have to accept an environment without admin rights on their work PC either. So the only solution to get around with a decent GTD system is to deal with the stuff one's got, and this may be Lotus Notes or even Outlook. If you're not sure how GTD works, please check it out before you continue here by looking up Getting Things Done in Wikipedia. What I've learned is that with only a bit of work, you can install a well-working GTD system, even in the standard built-in Lotus Notes task management system. Also, it doesn't provide the fancy features of a full-blown GTD application, like OmniFocus, Things, or Remember the Milk. But all that isn't a must if you only want to run your system, provided that you set up your workflow in a slightly geeky way. For myself, it worked out like this. Apart from having due dates for all tasks, which is a basic feature in almost all softwares, a must for all GTDers is the ability of linking context to the tasks. In Notes, this can be done by using the category field in the task application's graphical user interface. The only thing you need to do is to write the context in the category field, and Lotus Notes, after hitting enter, will remember the category for reuse, which is basically tagging the tasks. But first things first. Going that way, you need to think about a structure that works best for you. I've chosen the following one so I can distinguish between contexts being places, persons, or projects. An at the beginning of a category or tag signifies a place, context like at work, at phone, at computer, at home, at errands, etc. A hyphen signifies a person to interact with or to talk to, like hyphen John Miller, hyphen spouse, hyphen boss, hyphen Erica, or so on. And a dot signifies a project the task is allocated to, like dot Christmas, dot vacation, dot garage sale, or dot you name it. Since Lotus Notes allows multi-tagging in the category field, you can add all context needed to each single task to be completed. So if I have to call the butcher for the Christmas roast, the task would be call butcher for Christmas roast, then the phone number, the due date, which might be 2011-12-20, and the following tags separated by a comma, at phone, comma, dot Christmas, comma, hyphen, spouse. I think you've got the idea now. If you now want to view the tasks with the same assigned context, you simply have to click on the View by Category field in the left column of the Tasks page within Lotus Notes. In order to not being forced to type in the same context over and over again, I use a very smart application called Brevi, that could also be called Text Expander for PC. The software expands abbreviations to full text on a system-wide basis. The good thing about Brevi is that there's a portable edition for Brevi as well. This can be installed locally on your PC without admin rights enabled. For my needs, I've chosen abbreviations for the text snippets to expand in every application on the PC when typed in, like at P for at phone, or at W for at work, or hyphen JJM for hyphen John Miller, or so on. Apart from the ease of writing at the first place, it is also essential for not ending up with a bunch of almost similar category tags due to typos or different writings like at computer with all capital letters or at computer with only an initial capital letter or different writings of John Miller and equivalent. After going through this all, you can easily review your tasks now by going to the View by Category section in a task application within Lotus Notes. Pick the phone list by expanding Add Phone, and if you've been smart enough to copy and paste the phone number of the butcher into the tasks, you can end up having the phone list for your way from or to work handy by either transferring it to your mobile device or printing it out before leaving the office. In case you're using a BlackBerry handheld synced with your work PC, you can also find the task list in your applications folder. Within the task list, you can set a filter to the Add Phone category tag in order to see all Add Phone related actions being due. Then start phoning the people listed thereunder by double-clicking on the highlighted phone number. This also works for the category at errands, so you can have a well-prepared list of items doing your groceries, or for the categories with the hyphen being person-related categories. So if you go seeing a coworker you need to interact with, you still know what you wanted to talk with him. I hope this all was helpful for you. So keep on GTDing and keep on tagging.
Well, thank you so much, Jans. That was really, really interesting. Several years ago, I did read Getting Things Done, The Art of Stress-Free Productivity by David Allen, but I gotta confess, I never really implemented it. I did go so far as to make labels for my paper folders, though, and I hung each one in its own pendaflex. Does that count? That was in the book. It said to do that. Well, anyway, I bet your instructions are going to be really helpful to a lot of people, whether they use Lotus Notes or not. I bet that kind of tool could really help in a lot of different applications. I may even give your ideas a try with my email application. So a few weeks ago, we went to San Diego to celebrate Steve and my birthdays, and I took a ton of photos. I, of course, bartered the heck out of them in Aperture, winnowing them down to the best of the best, sir, with honors. When it came time to upload to Facebook, I instinctively used the poster plugin from reinventedsoftware.com. I told you about this little application when it first came out, but I just felt like reminding you about it today because I like it so much. If you find it tedious to upload via the built-in functionality in iPhoto and Aperture, I hate their interfaces, you might really like Poster a lot more. It works as both a plugin, like I said, or you can use it as a standalone application. It's beautiful, it's fast, it lets you describe and tag your photos all before they go up so people don't start looking at them before you've got them all ready. My friend Diane has only just recently started using Facebook and just started using a Mac, and this week she complained to me about how much she hates the native interface in Facebook for uploading photos. She doesn't use Aperture or iPhoto to organize her photos because she uses Picasa. I told her about Poster. She bought it and immediately told me how intuitive she thought it was and how much better she likes it. I know this sounds like a commercial, and I swear it isn't. It's just that I really enjoy this software. I love the developer, Steve Harris. He's the same guy who wrote Feeder, my favorite podcast feed application where I read all my show notes. Steve is the number one most responsive developer I've ever worked with. Anyway, go check it out. It's only $10, and there's even a free 15-day trial from reinventedsoftware.com. Well, Nightwise is back with another one of his unique reviews, this time for a new traveling mic setup. Let's have a listen.
Hello, Allison. Nightwise from Nightwise.com calling with a review of today, a mobile podcast recording setup. Well, as it's since we're playing by the rules, let's start with a problem to be solved. The problem is you are an awesome podcaster. Really, an awesome podcaster. The universe and the internets don't recognize you as the next Leah Laporte, but you are an awesome podcaster. But you spend almost 3 hours a day in the car. Now, in order to become an awesome podcaster, you need to put out awesome podcasts, and you don't have a lot of time. I mean, once you get home, there's life to deal with, you are at work, in the mornings it's all early, but you do have 3 hours every day in the car. So, how to solve this problem? How to be an awesome podcaster, possibly the next Leo Laporte or even better, and still be able to put out content while you are on the road? Well, the answer comes in the form of available technology. This is, to anybody with a little bit of a Macintosh bias, technology within the reach of your hand and your budget, and it will enable you to put out good quality content and be safe while doing it and being very productive and, you know, making good use of your time. Let me just start off by lining out what I wanted. It's not that I'm an awesome podcaster. Perhaps I am, but the internet might not have recognized me as yet. But I do spend 3 hours in the car every day. And recording podcasts, listening to podcasts, actually is something that helps me spend my time. Now, instead of just, you know, shouting against my iPod or having great ideas and having nowhere to go with them because, you know, I have to drive the car and mind the road, I came up with the idea, why not start recording my podcasts in the car? So I did a little bit of research, and this is about 4 years ago, that helped me find an iRiver recorder and a silly Belkin lapel microphone. Now, this is a lapel microphone, it's stereo, it's very sensitive, and when I did record my podcast in the car, and I have done several, it kind of picked up a lot of road noise, and I had to talk fairly loud to be heard. Now, unfortunately, the iRiver recorder broke. It's just dead. I can't record on it anymore, and I had the choice of, well, buying a new one or using my Zoom H2 microphone with an external microphone, of course, because you can't hold it while you're driving. And I thought, like, darn, this is not what I want. I looked around at the technology that was around me, and I took a good look at my iPod Touch, my fourth generation iPod Touch, and what I had lying about. Now, I did remember that the quality of recording on the iPod Touch and on the iPhone is very, very good. I remember when you came down to Belgium, you did an entire interview with me sticking your iPhone underneath my nose and making me talk. Well, you actually held the iPhone upside down and it still sounded good. So I thought, I need to find a way to incorporate all this technology that I have into a simple solution that allows me to create content while on the road safely, cheap, on the cheap, and with high quality. Enter my quest for a recording device. As a recording device, I said, okay, it has to be my iPod Touch. Now, this can be your iPod Touch or your iPhone or your iOS device. If it comes with a microphone, you're good. Second generation iPods, not going to happen. The second generation iPod Touch is not going to happen. But, you know, iPhones and the new iPod Touches with a built-in microphone, you might just have a chance. So I thought, this is the device I want to use to record on, because I carry it around everywhere. It has storage capacity and it has high quality. But, you know, just holding it in front of my mouth and talking into the built-in microphone wasn't really an option, because, quite frankly, I am on the road, I am on the freeway, I need both hands on the steering wheel, and I need to concentrate on my, well, on what's ahead of me and what's behind me, check my mirrors, stuff like that. So if I want to babble along, it has to be in a way that I don't have to use any of my, well, physical parts. So I thought, okay, I'll use the iPod Touch as a recorder. I need to find some software to do that with. And I just found the standard voice recorder for the Mac. It records audio on there in a compressed form, but the quality is very high. And once you get home, you can just hook it up to your Mac and drag off the recorded sound files using iTunes, because they come in the voice memos playlist, but you do have to enable synchronizing voice memos as well. Now, this voice memo app is very simple, but it does what it does pretty good. You have an analog volume meter, so you can see how loud you're talking, and you have the ability to immediately listen to what you recorded on the application. And it's built in with the iPod. It's as vanilla as it gets. So you need an iPod or an iPhone, and this application comes with it. Now comes the quest. Because, you know, you can't hold it in your hands, the device, the phone, or the iPod Touch. You need to have a microphone, and a microphone preferably that you can put somewhere on your head so you have your hands free. Now, there are, of course, the insanely expensive Apple headphones with the built-in microphone. Now, these are good for making phone calls. I mean, you'd have your earbuds in your ear, and you just, you know, kind of talk, and the microphone picks up the sound, and it's all great. And to be honest, they are very good. I mean, they cost an insane amount of money, but the ones, even the ones that you get with your iPhone, are pretty good. The quality is pretty good. But when you're driving around in the car and you're sitting down and the iPhone or the iPod Touch is in your lap, it's not really convenient. The microphone's on a wire, the wire twists and turns so the volume of your voice changes, the microphone scrapes against your shirt or against the jacket that you're wearing. It's nice for a phone call, but it's not really optimal to use when you want to record something that you're going to put into a podcast, because it's not nice for your listeners to listen to. So I thought, like, okay, I need something else. So what you can actually do is get an external microphone. Now, this external microphone needs to be able to hook up with your iOS device. And here's where Apple cheats a bit. Because, quite frankly, the Apple device, your iPhone or your iPod Touch, has a mini jack input where you plug in the headphones, and with the iPad, the iPod Touch, and the iPhone, it comes with a three-ringed mini jack. Now, what does this mean? It means that there are inside that mini jack are two connections to form a stereo sound to your headphones, and also a connection to hook up a mono microphone, all via the same plug and via the same wire. So I tried plugging in my standard microphone, the little lapel mic that I still had, but that didn't work. The Mac didn't pick it up. I tried some other microphones with a mini jack, but that didn't work. And the reason for that is that the mini jack inside the iPhone or the iPod Touch is a little different. It's differently organized, and you need an adapter. Enter the people from TouchMic. The people from TouchMic make two adapters, a mini jack female to mini jack three ringed adapter to hook up any mini jack microphone, or one with both a mini jack and a headphone connector, so you can hook up a mini jack microphone and standard headphones into the mini jack of your iPhone or iPod Touch. These adapters cost about $10 a piece, I think. I'll put the link in the show notes that I'll send you. But they are very, very well made, and they have very, very good quality. So I went looking around for adapters to hook up standard mini jack equipment, headphones and microphones, to the iPhone or the iPod Touch, and I found these two. Now, the only thing I needed to do was test it. So I kind of got my little lapel mic out and I tested it. On the iPad and the iPod Touch, it didn't work. On the iPhone, on the other hand, it did work. Just plugging in the adapter, plug in my lapel mic, use the voice recorder, everything worked right out of the box on the iPhone 4. So you don't need, you just need these adapters on the iPhone 4. On the iPod Touch and the iPad, it didn't work. And I was kind of stunned. Why not? I took it up with the people at TouchMic. They didn't know what was wrong. It turns out that you need to have a amplifier for the iPad and the iPod Touch for these devices to work. This has to do with different kinds of microphones and condenser microphones and impedance microphones. I don't know the technical term. Somebody will be screaming at their iPod right now. Get a microphone. But, you know, there are different kinds of microphones. And with the iPod Touch and the iPad, you need one of these amplifiers. Now, these are tiny, tiny things with a little battery inside that have a mini jack connector for your microphone on one end and a mini jack plug to plug into your touch mic adapter on the other hand. That cost me about €5. Then it was time to look for a microphone. I tried it with the lapel mic. That worked, but as I said, the lapel mic picked up a lot of road noise. So I went over to my local sound and light shop that sells mixers and stuff like that, and I asked the guy, you know, I want to record something in the car and it has to sound good. He suggested the HM06PS boom microphone from JB Systems. This is a very sturdy built microphone with a mount that goes behind your head. There are two arches in that mount that go over your ears and keep it steady. It presses against your skull pretty firmly so it doesn't shake or wobble, which is important. Then you have the actual boom, which is made out of iron, not out of plastic, so it's pretty sturdy. And it comes with a microphone and a piece of, a wind coating at the very end. I tried it out and I was amazed. The quality was sublime. Well, if I haven't convinced you now, it has a very... I'm recording with this microphone at the moment, so as you know, as you can hear, it sounds very good. But I will also say that, and I'll try to let you hear it, I'm in the car at the moment. I'm currently cruising at speeds varying from 90 kilometers an hour to 140 kilometers an hour, and you hardly hear any road noise. The microphone is fantastic. And now for the price. Okay, I know what you're going to say. This is almost professional equipment. This is going to cost me. Well, if I take a look at the, well, poor excuse for an exchange rate for the dollar that you have right now, and I take a look at what it cost me in euros, the microphone will set you back about 40 euros. At about $40, it's about 30 euros. So $40, you know, do the math. Translate it in Google. Costs about 30 euros. The adapter cost me about $10. The little preamp cost me about, I think, 5 euros or something. So under 50 euros, I've got my complete mobile podcasting set if I don't count in the iPod Touch. So if you want to be a mobile podcaster or even use this set at home, this will help you get started. It's an amazing way to kind of put together a podcast recording setup using tools that you have and tools that are within anybody's budget. So just take a look at it. If you have an iPhone, you don't even need the amplifier. You just need the touch mic adapter and the boom microphone and you're good to go. If you want to do this on an iPod Touch or an iPad, you need the little preamp adapter as well. I tried this even on the iPad with a new GarageBand and it's amazing. I mean, it's like a little recording studio all on its own and I absolutely love this because this is hardware that I bought for different functions. I bought my iPod Touch to play music. Now I'm using it to record podcasts. I bought my iPad to play Angry Birds. Now I'm using it as kind of a little recording studio with GarageBand and stuff. And it doesn't cost me an arm and a leg. So for those of you out there that want to get it, so an iOS device will do with a microphone in, so an iPhone or an iPod Touch or an iPad. The touch mic adapter set you back $5, the little active amplifier about $5 as well, and the JB microphone, the the HM06PS. So build yourself a recording studio and become the next awesome mobile podcaster. I've been rattling on for long enough. Back to Allison.
Well, I always loved Nightwise's version of things, and the way he describes things is fantastic. And by the way, I talked to him after he sent this in, and I mentioned the popping he was getting, and he said, yeah, he worked on repositioning the microphone headset over time, and he's been able to get rid of that. So don't hold it against the microphone. I've got pictures of the headset mic and the little adapter he got in the show notes. So and links to buy them. They don't appear to be, I'm not sure how you do it if you're in the United States, but hey, that's what those guys deal with all the time when we put US links. So figure it out if you want to get one of those. So I was thinking about what applications make me happiest on my Mac. And I think it's actually the entire category of utilities that make me more efficient. The king of these applications has to be Text Expander from Smile. I've been using Text Expander for as far back as I can remember, and I'm still learning new things about what it can do. A few weeks back, I wrote to them asking if there was a way to create a snippet to change a lowercase I into uppercase. For some reasons, my fingers have just gotten lazy over the years, and I often simply don't capitalize the first-person pronoun. Gene from Smile wrote back and gave me instructions that revealed this whole set of options, which I'd never even looked. I haven't been using groups all that much, but she showed me a great reason to use them. For a given group, you can set options just for that group. For example, expand after whitespace. This was the key trick to getting the lowercase I to turn into an uppercase I. I had tried doing it, but without having that expand after whitespace, it wasn't ever going to work. So with Text Expander, you get high efficiency, great support, options beyond what I can even tell you about. Maybe over time I'm going to learn the whole thing. Plus, it makes this really cute little sound whenever the abbreviations expand. Steve loves to hear that cute little sound expand. Anyway, check out Text Expander at smilesoftware.com.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions. Dumb questions.
How do I?
What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Hi, Kirshen. Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted over at podfeet.com. I have a dumb question I was hoping you could answer and maybe post on some podcast where other people could get the advantage of knowing the answer. I hear a lot of people talk about software having been signed, and they talk about signing companies, security companies that are somehow saying that, yeah, you're signed. Woohoo, that means you're signed. What does that mean? What do they actually do? If I have some code and I submit it to be signed, I don't get it. What happens? Does someone look at all my code and go, yeah, it's the real deal. There's no hacky weirdness in here. And that gives me a sign of approval. What does it even mean? Appreciate your help. Thanks, Kirshen.
Hi, Allison. Kirshen from freerangecoder.com. Thanks for your dumb question on code signing. I looked around at various developer documents and other references on the web and found out more information. Here's what code signing is all about. It makes you, the user of an application, confident of two things. One, that the application indeed came from the application author. This is something typically called authentication. And two, that no one has tampered with the application. For instance, its executable code or scripts. This is usually referred to as integrity. You can think of authentication as analogous to the situation where you visit a secure HTTPS website, such as a bank. The identity of these secure websites have been validated by a third-party agency. Such validating agencies are called certificate authorities or CAs, and examples of some of these are Thought and VeriSign. CAs provide a file called a digital certificate to the website owner, and it is this file that essentially pronounces that the site is who it says it is. The CA embeds its digital signature in the certificate, along with other information about the website being authenticated, so that the web browsers can check the validity of the website. So in the case for authentication for an application, the developer obtains a digital certificate from a CA and uses that along with a cryptographic code to sign their application. This is used with the Mac OS X code signing tool called CodeSign. More on that later. And that authenticates the application. In order to provide integrity for various code and resource components in an application, a developer can opt to sign each application content item individually. The code signing tool generates and associates a special value for these items. This special value is called a hash. Changing the contents of any of these signed items, even ever so slightly, will result in a different hash value, meaning that Mac OS X can detect if an application has been altered. As an aside, a Mac OS X application appears to be one file, since the Finder shows and treats it that way. However, you can peer into the contents of an application by control or right-clicking on the application file icon and selecting Show Package Contents from the context menu. Just remember to close that Finder window showing the application contents when you're done looking in there. How code signing works is a rather deep topic, involving public key cryptography systems, digital certificates, and the like. I've put up links to the Wikipedia and Apple developer resources in the show notes if you'd like to read further. now. When I read Apple's code signing guide in the Mac OS X developer library, it mentioned that code signing does not guarantee that the code is free of security vulnerabilities or contains unsafe code, for example, untrusted plugins. What's more, code signing is not a copy protection or digital rights management system. Mac OS X can determine that the code signature is invalid, but this does not prevent the user from running the application. Apple provides a code signing and signature validation tool in the Mac OS X Unix command shell. This is called CodeSign and can tell you if an application happens to be properly signed. For more information, check out the code signing documentation at Apple's developer site. When application developers submit their programs to the Mac App Store, these programs have to be code signed with a digital certificate from Apple. Next, the programs have to go through Apple's review process, which makes sure, to the best of the reviewer's abilities, that the program is doing what the developer says it does, adding more assurance to the program. Does this mean that non-Mac App Store programs are not to be trusted? Of course not. My take is that Apple just wants to make sure that the programs it accepts into the Mac App Store have passed its review process, much like iOS programs going through a similar process for the iTunes App Store. Now let's get a little more down to earth. My sweetie had a problem with iTunes on a MacBook Air. iTunes kept coming up with a dialogue saying, "Do you want iTunes to accept incoming network connections?" and showing deny or allow buttons every time it was launched. This happened after we installed iTunes 10.2.1 via software update. I also managed to reproduce the problem on my iMac. Searching around, I found an article in the Apple discussion forums, now known as Apple support communities, describing the same problem. The article showed how to diagnose the problem using CodeSign and, more importantly, provided a fix, which was to remove and reinstall iTunes from a fresh download. Do check out my article on freerangecoder.com detailing the problem and its solution, link in the show notes. Code signing. It's a pretty deep topic, but the problem it solves is simply that code signing assures us, the application users, of the veracity of the application's origin and the integrity of its contents. Once again, thanks for letting me share an answer to a dumb question, and I'll be seeing you all in the Bitstream.
Thank you so much, Kirshen. That's the first time I have ever gotten to be the one to ask the dumb question. Well, except for every single time Bart's on the show. I definitely ask a lot of dumb questions there, but we don't play the music and everything. I listened to it 3 times, and now I think I'm pretty much getting it. It's a lot clearer than it was, that's for sure.
MyMac.com podcast. This is
MyMac.com
podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bite. Actually, before we begin, last Sunday, I was kind of surfing around and I saw that Allison was online. Right. So I went and I looked, and it turns out, and I didn't know this, Sunday night is when she records her show.
You Correct.
Know, I listen to her show like every single week, and she always says, "We record on Sunday nights," and it never like quite clicked into my head that meant, oh, she records on Sunday nights and I could actually listen to it. So I went into the chat room, and cool. The weird thing was my name actually changed somehow while I was in the chat room. It started off as being Mac Parrot, and then somehow got switched over to my other weird alias, which is Mac Hippie. So everybody was like, wait a second, Mac Parrot, that's Guy. Who's Mac Hippie? He's like, no, that's Guy too. And you know, you could just see like the collective shrug of everyone that was in the chat room. Okay. So, but it was so much fun listening to Allison's show. We'll give him a free plug here. The NosillaCast podcast. Great, great show. Visit Honda Bob. Even if you don't live in Los Angeles, just call.
Ring him up. Ring him up. If you're in New York, ring him up and say, "How much did you charge to come to New York?"
I've got a Honda in Bucharest. I need you to come fix my Honda. Oh, good God! No, we're having way too much fun tonight. one of the things that...
You can call Honda Bob from Bucharest by dialing the country code 001-562-531-2321. H.A. Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda Acura or Honda Worldwide. Well, last week I started thinking that I really might stop doing security light because I don't really feel like I'm adding all that much value, you know, that you really do deserve. I can't pretend to be Bart in this segment, that's for sure. I just don't have the background training or understanding of a lot of the subtleties. I probably won't be doing it very much anymore, but this week I do have to tell you about two things because I actually do know what I'm talking about in this case. First, let's talk about the LastPass breach. I talked to you a while ago about LastPass. It's a terrific place to store your secure passwords for your credit cards, for your financial information, absolutely everything that you want to keep really, really safe and you want to have a good password on. If you hadn't heard, on May 4th, the folks at LastPass discovered an anomaly that gave them pause. To quote their very transparent blog on that actual day, here's what they said. Tuesday morning, we saw a network traffic anomaly for a few minutes from one of our non-critical machines. These happen occasionally, and we typically identify them as an employee or an automated script. In this case, we could not find that root cause. After delving into the anomaly, we found a similar but smaller matching traffic anomaly from one of our databases in the opposite direction. More traffic was sent from the database compared to what was received on the server. Okay, so they couldn't explain the anomaly, and they took a preemptive measure to secure the data. I'm not going to read you all of what they discovered. I put a link in the show notes to the blog so you can read it yourself. Instead, I'd rather talk about what this actually means to you from a security point of view for your most important passwords. Steve Gibson of Security Now was on Tech News Today, episode 236, and there's a link to that in the show notes as well. He explained how LastPass stores your data. They take your email address and your single master password, and they hash them together to encrypt them. Then they hash that combination together again with the password. This is all done client-side, so the people at LastPass never do have your master password. They couldn't figure it out if they wanted to, even though they have all the data and everything about it. So in this situation from the past week, a small amount of data may have leaked out, but there's no way any potential hackers could ever break into your account as a result of that. Even if they downloaded the entire LastPass database, they still couldn't break into your account. This is the reason that Steve Gibson is such a big fan of LastPass and why, as a security expert, he recommends it so highly. The only concern you should have would be if you had used a dictionary word as your LastPass master password. Because given your data, potential hackers could do a brute force attack to guess your password. But let's be serious for a minute. If you're smart enough to use LastPass, are you likely to have used a dictionary word for your password? I'm thinking no. All right, we have a second security light topic. Let's talk about Skype. It seems like there are several ways you can screw up in the security front. One is to have vulnerabilities in the software you've written or the capabilities you've created. Another way is to not fix those vulnerabilities. But the folks at Skype have actually come up with a unique way to screw up. They have a vulnerability, they fixed it, but they didn't tell anyone there's a fix. So let's back up for a minute. Pure Hacking discovered a vulnerability in Skype 5 for Mac that's pretty frightening. They figured out how to send a message to someone on Skype that had a payload in it that gave them access to a command line shell, thus gaining complete control over the other person's Mac. The folks at Pure Hacking contacted Skype, who according to them basically said, "Yeah, we know about that one. Hotfix coming." All right, so far that's fairly normal, but what Skype did next was absolutely idiotic. They came out with version 5.1.0.922, which fixed the vulnerability. But if you launch Skype, it does not prompt you to accept the update. The fix has been there since April 14th. In the past, I've said things to you like, let Firefox update itself, or let Chrome update itself, or let OS X update itself. But in this case, I have to say, launch Skype 5, go up to the menu and choose Check for Updates, and only then do you get the update to version 5.1.0.922, and can you be safe again on your Mac. Jeez. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond. This time we're going to call it Chit Chat Across to a separate country at least. I have Andy Walker with me of Labrats.tv, hosted on Butterscotch, and many other things that he's going to explain to me. How are you doing today, Andy?
I am great. How are you?
I'm doing good. So we actually, I became a big fan of yours when you were on Call for Help. And then I remember going up and gushing at you and Sean Carruthers when you were at Blog World Expo. And I gushed like an Uber fan, and you guys politely were nice to me anyway.
No, I think we gushed back. Did we gush back?
I'm sure that's what
gushed
it was.
Yeah, of course, clearly.
So before we got in the air, we started to talk, and I stopped you. So you're also the general manager of Two Cows?
Yeah, so twocows.com is an important distinction. So about 3 years ago, Sean and I entered into an alliance to take Labrats into the Butterscotch, well, into the Two Cows content fold. And as part of that deal, I became the general manager of twocows.com, which is their content division.
Okay.
And then we created Butterscotch.com. So I don't run the domains business. That's my boss. He's the CEO, Elliot Noss.
Okay.
But I'm one of the soldiers. I'm the GM in the content division of Two Cows.
Okay. All right. And then what exactly is Butterscotch? I know Butterscotch as Labrats, so.
Right. Well, so Labrats, of course, is a tech show that demystifies technology. And we've been around for, how many years? 5 years now?
Yeah, you're pioneers.
Butterscotch.com. Was it?
You're pioneers.
We are pioneers. Yeah, we around since, while we were, recording video with, rocks, I think. It was back in the day, right?
Right, right.
So Butterscotch.com is a technology site really kind of designed to replace what was tech TV in many ways. Revision 3, we're kind of a competitor to those guys, although they're dear friends of ours. And so Butterscotch.com has dozens and dozens of shows. In fact, we have 4,400 pieces of video on the site.
That wow.
Gives you everything from, how do I use Twitter, to the show about Labrats, to a show called Miss Download, to a show designed to help you understand the latest app on your mobile phone. And recently we reinvented ourselves from just a general technology to mobile. So we call ourselves the Sweet Mobile Network. So we produce content around tablets and smartphones and anything sort of mobile oriented that because the world really kind of away from the desktop and started on this sort of mobile device type of thing now.
Right. So it sounds like I was missing an awful lot of what Butterscotch was. To me, Butterscotch and Labrats was synonymous, but it looks like it does an awful lot more than that.
Yeah, well, Labrats was sort of the lead show on Butterscotch, but we built a studio in Toronto. We have 4 producers and a network of hosts and that sort of thing. So we do, I think, if you go on the site, it's probably 14 or 15 shows that we've done in the history of the site. We're currently producing about 6 or so, and half of our content is tutorials. How do I use Twitter? How do I use my iPhone? Sean does this really great series called How Do I? How do I use my BlackBerry Torch? That kind of thing. So,
ooh,
really
I could use that one.
Yeah, could you? Yeah, you got a BlackBerry Torch, right?
Yeah.
So, and it's designed so that if we do a 5-part series or 10-part series, it starts off with what is this device, or why do I even very basic for dummy type stuff. By the time you get to the 5th or the 10th episode, depending on how long the series is, we're starting to introduce pretty advanced concepts. So if you watch the entire series, you're going to get a really good encapsulation of what this device or what the topic is about, from beginner stuff all the way up to pretty much advanced stuff.
I had no idea any of this was here. I my impression was you guys were Labrats.tv, and all of a sudden you were under Butterscotch. I thought Butterscotch bought you.
Well, there was a business alliance of sorts, and part of the deal, Sean and I had to become part of the Two Cows. We had to become Two Cows employees,
right?
So let's say Labrats was creatively acquired by Two Cows to be on the Butterscotch network.
Oh, okay. So would you say Butterscotch is a subset of Two Cows?
Yeah. So now as the general manager of twocows.com, the content division, I run twocows.com, which of course is the world famous file download site. So I run that, and I built and created Butterscotch.com, which is inside of my portfolio of responsibilities as the general manager of content at Two Cows Inc.
Wow. I thought you were just the pretty face on Labrats.
I'm not just hair and teeth, Allison. So much more.
Well, this is, wow, this is even more interesting than I thought. You're kind of a busy guy, I'm thinking. Well, the first thing I wanted to do was harass you. I've been a longtime watcher of Lab Rats, and you used to be a card-carrying Windows user, and now I see you sporting the MacBook there.
I know. Isn't that just a shock? Complete shock.
How did that happen?
Well, you know, so I wrote, what, 3 books on Windows. I wrote, you know, a couple of security books and a Windows Vista help desk book. And has always been a Windows guru, always eschewed the, you know, Steve Jobs and his crazy culty minions. except that a couple of years ago.
Resistance is futile, Andy.
Exactly. So ultimately, you know, it was probably 2 years ago now, you know, I went through the Windows pain, right? And if you read my book, The Windows Vista Help Desk, you'll see I was really, really hard on Windows. Windows 7 came along too late as far as I'm concerned. I was running a Dell Windows 7 machine and just went, I think I've had it with this platform. You know, I had to reinstall twice after, you know, and Windows 7 is a good platform, mind you, but the machine, you know, had me reinstall twice in the first 6 months. You know, there was security issues. Outlook kind of exploded on me, and I thought, you know, enough, I'm done. And you know, Sean had been taunting me for years about Apple, and I'd been resisting. And I finally went, okay, if this is the best machine on the market, I'm going to prove it wrong or prove it right. So I bought one, and I switched everything over. And I got to tell you, I love my MacBook Pro.
Oh, no.
I have not looked back.
Now, that's interesting. You know, I went from the Mac at work. I went from the Mac to Windows Vista, and I basically felt like I was driving a red-hot poker through my forehead every day. So when I went to Windows 7, to me, it was kind of like, you know, I stopped hitting myself in the head every day. But I still find myself yelling, seriously, people choose this? You know, it's just, I don't know. I think I've borked my system up, and I'm trying to blame myself, not the platform. But I'm terrified to reinstall the OS because I don't really know what I'm doing. Yeah. But what a mess that thing is now.
Well, we have a whole series on how to reinstall and reformat Windows 7, you know, at Butterscotch. So if you want to watch those tutorial series, I'll show you exactly how to do it.
You know, I might just do that because I'm just terrified because I don't know where it stores stuff, you know. I'm pretty sure I'll come back and I know the backup software. I'm using the MyBook series and has the built-in backup software. And it does absolutely backs up really, you know, rock-solid backup program. It works great. But then I just realized it's not backing up things like my archives of my email. There's no option to get to that folder within the software. So I know there's stuff I got to go get, and that terrifies me.
It's called a .pst file in Outlook. You just got to grab that, that's all. But then when you dump it across, you got to do all kinds of little tweaks and weirdnesses, so we won't go into it right now. But you know, it is not easy, right? Windows is not easy. The reason people jump into Windows is for several reasons. One, as you probably all know, super cheap, right? You can pick up a machine that's a Windows 7 machine for, you know, under $500 and likely under $300 these days if you're going to go for a netbook, right? So that's it. You know, loads and loads of shareware and software and freeware, more so than the Mac, although the Mac has had a nice portfolio on the back end. But if you go to tucows.com, you know, we have 26,000 pieces of software you can download for your Windows machine, right? Versus maybe, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 on the Mac side. So really, it's dominated there. But frankly, you know, the operating system platform wars are completely done as far as I'm concerned. This is the year where we shift from the desktop and its relevance and its importance to mobile. And increasingly, so if I go to 5 of my friends right now and I go, where do you deal with your email and the web? At least 2 out of 5 of them will say, you know, on my mobile device only.
Oh, yes, interesting. You
know? So really, this is the inflection point. This is the year where we say goodbye to the desktop and, decreasingly the laptop, and the year where we're starting to look at mobile devices as our primary computing device. So, you know, if you look at the new Motorola Atrix, you know, it now has a docking station that has a screen and a keyboard, and it becomes your laptop. But it's a smartphone, right?
Right, so it fits in your pocket most of the time, but when you want to act like a computer, it can.
Exactly. And then, you know, by extension, you want a larger screen built in. Really, the smartphone without the phone and with a screen becomes a tablet PC. You know, so, and if you look at, you know, the success of the iPad and the iPad 2 and all the Android devices that are out there, you know, really, this is the year when we say goodbye to the traditional computer. Like that word computer, so it's becoming archival or archaic, I guess.
Right. It doesn't mean anything anymore.
No, it doesn't, right? It's almost a quaint term these days. So this is really interesting. We've been following this trend very, very closely at butterscotch.com. You know, really doing a lot of app coverage and doing a lot of how-to coverage, and you know, we have a brand new series called, that was a weekly series called Android Weekly, and we're following the Android platform really, really closely now, because that's really going to be the next dominant mobile platform. It already has become that.
Well, let's start talking about that. You did a little set on LabRats last week, I think it was, of why you might want to switch to Android versus an iPhone.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, so for one, you know, the shipments have overtaken the iPhone, right, relative, you know, and so Android shipments versus the iPhone overtaken. Well, not surprising. Why? Because it's on multiple platforms and multiple vendors, lots of form factors. The iPhone, you got a choice of two, the 3GS or the 4, shortly the 5, probably this fall, you know, iPhone 5. But, you know, in the Android world, if you want a keyboard, you can have one. If you don't want one and just want touch, you can have one. If you want a tablet, you can have one, right? So really lots of options on that side of things. So it really configures the way that you want to interface with your mobile device. Really great reason to switch to Android, right?
Now, do you deal much with, let's call them normal people? The reason I'm asking the question is because my world is so slanted towards people who are into technology is that I mean, the reason I would buy an iPhone would be for the apps, not because it's a telephone. That's almost an irrelevant part of the device now. What I'm wondering, though, is whether most normal people walk into Verizon and they say, OK, I want a phone. And they look around and they see the one that has the keyboard and the look and feel that they like, and they buy it, and they never ever add anything to it. Do you think normal people might be like that?
Normal people are absolutely like that. You know, the geeks will, you know, do a crazy analysis and do a SWOT, SWOT analysis on a table and compare, you know, pros and cons. The average person, they go, I want a phone that makes calls, and you know, I can touch so that it does that cool thing with the spinny, you know, photos. Right. Or whatever the feature is that they saw their friend use. I have a really dear friend of mine who bought an iPhone because she thought it was cool to touch, and that was all. Right, had never downloaded an app, had never interfaced, you know, synchronized it with her desktop or anything like that. So you know, it's that ease of interface. Now, when they walk into that store, into Verizon, they buy something. You know, what they choose to buy is going to come up to two things. One, does it match the feature that their friend told them about? And number two, is the price point right? And, you know, Apple is definitely a premium experience. And the Android, you know, the price points are coming down like crazy to the point where, you know, within, if it's not already available, that a $99 Android phone is going to be available in about, you know, a day or so or 2 days or a week. You know how it goes.
Well, but there's a $49 iPhone.
Is there a 3GS now? Yeah, with a super crazy deal. Yeah, well, absolutely. And everybody's competing in that space too. But if you think
about
it.
Which is hysterical because the real cost of the phone is like $1,200 a year, right?
yeah, exactly. You're paying for it no matter what, right? And the cost of the service, of course, hides the actual real price. But I think you're going to find that, you know, with the, you know, the, how many handsets are out there right now? I think there's probably a good dozen or so that have either are there or have come and gone, you know. So people, exposure to choice is massive on the Android side. And unless they're really attached to the Apple and the Apple image and the Apple capabilities, you know, they're going to choose an Android phone. My mom has no idea of the difference between the two.
Okay, we need to talk about that. I heard you when you were talking about it being an open platform, you actually said your mom shouldn't root her Android. One of my absolute pet peeves in the world is when people always, when they want to choose the example of somebody who doesn't know what they're doing, they always say mom.
Well, my mom is not tech savvy. She's 67 years old, interested in, you know, the utility of mobile travel and, you know, being connected and all the rest of it. She will never root an Android phone. Never.
Okay,
ever,
but
never.
Will your dad?
My dad would go, what exactly is rooting? And he'll ask me and go, oh, that's not for me. So he's a little bit more advanced, right?
Wouldn't do it. But people always pick mom, and it drives me out of my mind because I happen to be a mother of two, and it drives me crazy. People always use that example.
Yeah, fair enough. Women, though, okay. So here's my experience, and let me get myself in a bit of trouble here, maybe.
But yeah, probably. You're halfway in the hole right now, so go ahead, dig.
But women are practical when it comes to technology, right? So they're going to look at my experience is that they look at a problem, a technology problem, go, well, why would you mess with it? Just leave it the way it is, right? Mostly. Now, you're a rare, rare exception. Most men, you know, they get in some trouble, take things apart, and they'll tinker and whatever. So that's a gender, you know, prejudice, perhaps, for better or for worse. But really, women will go, I'm not going to mess with it. If I want a new one, I'm going to get it because it has a better feature. I'm not going to mess around with the guts of it. And my mother complains to my father that he tinkers too much. and he breaks.
See, now I did. I asked somebody who used the phrase, who said, you know, so easy my mother could do it, kind of thing. And I asked her, you know, why she said that, and she said, because my father won't even try. My mother will try, but do it wrong.
Oh,
but at least she's open-minded to give it a shot, and that's why she used the example of her mother.
Yeah, different dynamic there, I guess, in that couple. You know, I guess it's what you grow up with.
I guess. See, I live in a world of so many technical women. I mean, let's look around at Amber MacArthur and you know, Kelly Lewis and me and Katie Floyd. And I mean, it just, we're everywhere. I don't see us as the anomaly at all.
No. Well, and in certainly in the geek circles, there's some really amazing. In fact, some of the women in the geek circles, like yourself, are way more techy than some of the men. So you're right. It's unfair.
Yeah, I dare you to say it's so easy your mother can do it next time you're talking to Amber.
Oh, Amber will punch me, but then Amber punches me in general. So,
in fact, you know. I might send her a note and ask her to punch you next time she sees you. Just,
yeah,
you know.
Sure, she'll drive over to my house just specially to do that.
That would be great.
She never gave me for the Jell-O affair.
That's right. Hey, so I do want to come back to your food-related explanations at some point. But to round out the Android discussion, one of the things that a lot of people talk about, and you mentioned, was the ability to do background processing. But I have asked probably 20 people who use Android, how's your battery life, right after they say that? And they go, oh, man, it sucks.
Yeah, yeah. No, you're right. Multitasking, you know, you're putting several things into memory, and it's going to crank through, especially things like GPS, run in the background. It's going to eat battery. That's the reality of it. If you look at a laptop and you run 5 programs at once, you know, the battery's going to die. It's just the reality of it.
So let's talk about normal people then. So I'm a normal person. I'm going to start playing my music, and then I'm going to flip over and I'm going to check my email, and then I'm going to forget that thing's still running.
Yeah, well, you know, normal people and geek people. I went into the Apple store the other day. The guy says my home button doesn't work. Why? Because I'm running too many things in memory. Now, that's not even true multitasking, right? He's saying it's interrupting the actual physical functionality of the device. So this is something that nobody has perfected on the mobile situation yet. Nobody's given you a self-managing application that's going to handle all that stuff or remind you. And so, you know, we're in early days still, right?
I don't know if I buy whether that was really happening. I mean, I don't ever shut any applications off. I just close, you know, I hit the home button and I open something else.
Yeah.
And I don't ever have any problems with memory that I know of.
Well, here's the thing. When I shut them all down, suddenly my home button started working again.
Hmm.
Right? So she says, and isn't it now? My guess is a known bug that they're not talking about. But anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. That does sound more like a bug than something expected, that's for sure. But I just, to me, this is back to Steve Jobs not letting you have background processing because he knows the experience would be bad. So until the experience can be good, he won't let you have it.
That's right. Exactly.
He's our benign dictator.
He is. Now, here's what's going to happen in the Apple and the Android world. Somebody's going to build an app that says manage your background processes and do it for you, and it's going to be branded by UniBlue or one of those utility companies, and there'll be a whole new industry around it. You know, Steve Jobs is going to do it for you when he gets around to releasing the next version of iOS.
Right, and it'll be lovely, and you will like it.
And you will like it with you, yeah, exactly. And you'll tattoo it on your bum.
Oh, my husband, Steve, just corrected me. He said benevolent dictator, not benign dictator.
benevolent.
I might as well correct it right now because I'd hear about it when I got off the phone. Well, let's switch gears a little bit. And what do you think about where Windows Phone 7 is going?
Interesting story there, right? You know, Windows Phone 7, of course, is Microsoft's new mobile platform based on the Zune. It looked like a kind of a bit of a dog coming out of the gate because nobody was supporting it. It was the also-ran, you know, behind BlackBerry, behind Android, behind, you know, Apple iPhone. Thank goodness for Nokia, you know, their CEO, who basically said, we're going to save this by making it our premium smartphone experience. Now, Sean and I just did an episode just to have a look at the features on it on LabRats. It'll be released in the next week or so, maybe a couple of weeks. We were really impressed with it, you know. Even Sean, who is the greatest, you know, Microsoft cynic on the planet, you know, said, you know what, if the other phones weren't around, I would take a hard look at this because it's not a bad little design. It's really clever. It's very solid. It works nicely. And, you know, and it's affordable. So with Nokia basically saying, you know, putting their brand against it and saying, we're going to carry this as a premium smartphone, I think that it's got a shot in the marketplace. Never underestimate Microsoft. So I think, it may be one of those things that fades into the history like Microsoft, Bob, but I don't think they're going to go gently into that good night.
Well, see, the way I'm looking at it is I feel a little bit like Microsoft is the snail in the story, you know, the snail and the hare. You know, it's just going to go along at its own pace until it gets there and gets it right. But this might not be a market that can tolerate that. And one of the main things is that they actually haven't yet pushed out a successful update of any functionality improvements at all.
No,
and it's been on the market for how long? It's been over a year, hasn't it?
Coming up to a year, yeah.
Yeah. So they've had these aborted attempts to install the update that gets you ready to be able to get updates, but yeah, that hasn't been very successful. They've had a couple of phones. I think it's actually still the one of the Galaxy lines, was it? I'm not sure which one it was, but they were still having trouble getting the pre-update out to people, and having no functionality differences, improvements in this kind of a market. I don't know. I don't think there's anything wrong with Windows Phone 7 from what I've heard and seen. I haven't gotten to play with one myself. I'll love to watch your episode on that, but it doesn't seem like they can catch up going that slow.
Well, remember the rule about Microsoft. This is their history, right? Version 1.0 always stinks, but surprises people that it even got out. Version 2 is the tweak version. Version 3 is where it hits. So we're about to see version 2 come out this year at some point, probably towards the end of the year, I imagine you'll see, you know, Windows Phone 7 version 2 of some flavor. Whether they call that or not is beside the point.
A good point. What will they call it?
Yeah, who knows? Windows Phone 7.5?
Yeah, it's got to be awful.
And by the way, the name stinks, by the way. And I don't know who's naming these products at Microsoft, but they should be fired.
They really should.
So, you know, 2012, if they last that long, and I think they will, they have pretty deep pockets. You know, they're still kicking around. Office and Windows are still making the money. So they're not going away anytime soon. If they can make it through in the marketplace until 2012, they'll have version 3 out, and it'll be a pretty kick-ass product. And they'll either unseat BlackBerry, buy BlackBerry, or, you know, somehow get themselves into the third place spot, and then they'll basically go to war with one of the contenders, and that's what they do.
So right? You mentioned BlackBerry. BlackBerry had their big BlackBerry World Love Fest where Steve Ballmer actually came out on stage. So, what did you think of the events coming out of the BlackBerry World?
Well, BlackBerry's in deep trouble, right? Now, interestingly enough, you know, so they've launched the playbook. It's been a moderate success, but they still have that grasp on the enterprise market. You know, nobody's going to get fired right now if you're an IT manager at a company, you choose a BlackBerry solution. Just like you're not going to get fired if you choose a Microsoft solution. So there's some really nice synergies there between Microsoft and BlackBerry. And if they get themselves into any more deep water, and with Steve Jobs floating around like that, they could be a target of an acquisition, right? If that happens, now and this is classic Microsoft, get rid of the biggest player that's the smallest competitor, right? So I would now. Who knows? I have no inside information, although I was sitting next to the director of operating systems the other day at RIM. And, you know, they're storming ahead with this QNX operating system that they've got. I think that they have a shot, but they're not executing well, and they do need a partner. Wouldn't be surprised if Microsoft is in conversations right now for an acquisition.
That would be interesting. The BlackBerry OS is still dreadful. I'm running BlackBerry OS 6 on a BlackBerry Torch, and I don't hate it as much as I've hated my other BlackBerries, but it's still, you know, the idea of going to a website, it's like, oh, I just want to shoot myself, you know? I just hate it.
They acquired a company called QNX a little while ago. This is the operating system that is actually running now on the Playbook tablet.
Right.
And they're going to be rolling that out in terms of all the smartphone operating systems, not all of them, but many of them moving forward over the next year or so. So you're going to see a whole different experience. And they kind of got it right. You know, half of their developers are former Palm developers.
Yeah,
right?
Hang on just a second. Is QNX a Linux variant?
I don't know. I don't know what the history is. I know they were a small company that was doing some mobile work, and then they got acquired. So, but it does... Linux, right? Sounds kind of Linuxy.
It's got an X in it.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, somebody can, you know, Wikipedia and see what happens, but I wouldn't be surprised if it has a Linux variation of some sort.
Now, I've heard people are pretty pleased with QNX on the BlackBerry Playbook, but it just seems again like such a poor attempt out of the gate.
Yeah, I mean, hard to say. I mean, I was impressed with the Playbook's UI. I think how it, you know, multitask, how it, you know, you can, it has the whole card-based system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really, really impressive. It's nice. It's a delight to play with. Is it refined? No. Is it perfect? Absolutely not. Is there a future? Is the fundamentals there? Yeah, 100%, right? So it will be really interesting to see, you know, what the future of that is and what happens on the BlackBerry platform.
I played with a playbook about 3 weeks before they actually were shipping, so it was a pre-release version, but it crashed so many times I couldn't even get into the experience to tell if I liked it or not. I did just Wikipedia it. It's a commercial Unix-like real-time operating system.
Yeah, which means it's got Unix code in it.
Yeah, yeah, right. It says Unix in there somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, you know, your experience there was classic, you know, pre-release upset. You know, the Blackwell Rim announced their product, you know, long before it was ever a shipping product, or even, you know, an alpha. Lots of hype around it. And, you know, they did the same thing with the BlackBerry Storm. You know, they needed a touch-capable, you know, computer or mobile phone. They rushed it to market. It was a pile of doo-doo.
That is the worst thing I have ever used. The worst gadget. I liked Vista better than I liked the BlackBerry Storm. That thing was hideous.
Absolutely. Yeah. So hideous and awful. But it proved to the world, even if it didn't sell, that they were in the touch game, you know, as bad an implementation as it was. And the playbook and how it was rushed to market and its battery life issues and all the development stuff, and even the fact that there's no calendar and email unless you're, you know, bridging it with your BlackBerry smartphone, you know, on that device, is just a classic example of them rushing this product to market to say, we're in the tablet business too, because our business partners are saying, we need a tablet. So these guys are rushing to market, right?
Yeah, let's make sure everybody knows exactly. We'll say that very, very definitively. If you don't have a BlackBerry, you don't have a built-in email, calendar, and contact system inside the BlackBerry playbook. You can use something like Gmail or Yahoo Mail, that sort of thing, but you can't. There isn't a mail program where you can put in your POP or MIME setting or your settings. You know, or IMAP settings, I should say.
Yeah, the app is unavailable unless you're bridged or tethered to your BlackBerry 3G phone.
So I picture this as, you know, the BlackBerry is you know, still a player, a decreasing, dropping player in the market, but, you know, not a huge percentage of the market. Now you've said the only people who can really enjoy this product are that small subset of the world. It just seems like...
Yeah, except that small subset of the world is completely invested in most enterprises across the planet, you know, in many ways. And, you know, it's really designed to be very secure. So the enterprise, the IT managers say, I trust this. They don't trust the iPad 2 as an enterprise product. They can't guarantee the security and that sort of thing.
Okay, but the statistics I've been seeing recently, let's see, right now, GigaOm is reporting 70% of Fortune 100 companies are testing iPhones right now. Are actively piloting or deploying. So I don't think that's really as true today as it was just a short while ago.
No, you're absolutely right. And Apple in the last 6 months has been recruiting enterprise-level developers, right? So they're really going to make a play into the business world. It makes a lot of sense. That's the market for RIM to lose, and they may lose it yet.
Yeah, they sure seem to be on the path to it to me.
Yeah. But I think you're going to see, I mean, if there's any truth to this, you know, suggestion that Microsoft would acquire RIM, it makes a whole lot of sense. Where does Microsoft make their money? On the desktop, in the enterprise space, right?
Right. So they understand enterprise.
Completely. So you can completely see it as an enterprise mobile solution. Maybe the BlackBerry, you know, becomes the, what would you call it? You know, the Microsoft playbook. You know, who's to say, right? That could be what's going on. It makes logical sense if you think through it. Now, is there any truth to the rumor? We don't know. It's just speculation at this point. But I would put some money on it that there's something going on in the back room. If not, an acquisition going on. Certainly some talks about that.
Hey, speaking of bad devices, did you ever get a chance to play with the HP Slate?
I did not. No. Sean did, though. Sean went, we sent him to San Francisco, and he actually went to the event. And he said, you know, not a bad little solution. But, you know, at this point, you know, is WebOS going to be a contender? You know, it's, you know, now it's sitting way behind in terms of, you know, fourth or fifth place. You know, so what's going to happen there? Hard to say. But then again, it's HP, deep pockets. There may be a play yet. And they may be an acquisition, you know, target for, not an acquisition target, but, you know, they may be talking to RIM as well. You never know. But it makes sense. The two largest computer makers in the world do not have a solid tablet strategy or a smartphone strategy that has any kind of legs.
See, so yeah, I think WebOS could make a difference there. The HP Slate I played with was running Windows 7, and I nothing is as bad as the BlackBerry Storm, but it's a contender.
Yeah, it's stinky, huh?
Yeah, it was pretty smelly. it was funny when I was trying to play with it, and the woman that was standing there, and she's going, use the stylus. And I said, I don't want to use the stylus. She goes, use the stylus. She kept telling me. And you pretty much had to use the stylus. You could use your finger, but it wasn't a happy time. So, now, well, what about Android tablets? So we still don't – do we actually have a full Android operating system for the tablet out yet? I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, no, we don't. We haven't seen Honeycomb. We've seen Honeycomb in pre-release versions. If you actually buy a Nook right now, you can actually hack it, and it's actually a full-on Honeycomb tablet, believe it or not. We did a little series on that. On how to do that. So, yeah, I'm not sure if anybody is shipping a Honeycomb yet. I'm not sure if the – maybe it's the Atrix, the Motorola the tablet. But that was either ready to go or, you know, was about to ship it or something like that. But
yeah,
anyway.
They did something where they allowed one of the vendors to get a head start on everybody else, but I forget who it was.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, we saw a pre-release version of that. It won't be long now. You know, Honeycomb's going to be all over the place. And really, that's going to solidify the Android tablet market in the back half of this year. As soon as Honeycomb – because Honeycomb's, of course, optimized as a tablet OS for tablets. So it'll be interesting to see what happens to the Android market if it hardens and, you know, really gives the iPad a run for its money. It's already – you know, they're already making headway there. So that'll be the big kind of moment where, you know, they really give iPad a run for its money.
Yeah, that could be interesting. Again, why is Honeycomb taking so long? Is it my imagination or is it taking a long time?
You want to get it right.
Google's
not stupid, right? Google really wants to own that platform. If you think about it, what is a tablet? It's a computer. Google wants to be in the operating system business because they want to be able to ship, you know, their products onto this thing by default. So they're not going to mess around. They may be taking their time. It's, you know, taking a while to develop. I think they're just being very careful because it's a make or break situation. If they miss the boat here, there's an opportunity for the competitors to either iPad to dominate more or, you know, for one of the other smaller guys to step up. So I think that that's what's going on there.
I think a lot of the Google strategy is going to get a lot more interesting if and when we ever get ubiquitous Wi-Fi or coverage of some sort. I think a lot of these companies are making the assumption that we already do, and maybe they live in San Francisco where there's a free Wi-Fi hotspot every 30 feet or something, but not where I live.
Well, I think the big play right now that's going to be, you know, obviously 3G HSPA or HSDPA, I think you guys call it in the U.S., and then, of course, LTE, which is the next generation 4G networks. That's really what's going to make the huge difference in terms of ubiquitous connectivity everywhere, at least in urban areas.
Well, right. But you live in Canada. There's a whole lot of space where I bet there's no signal at all, right?
Yeah. Well, right now, 3G connectivity is pretty much all the way down to the moderate-sized town level, and that's within 100 miles of the border, of course.
You go north.
Yeah, it gets less and less, certainly. But, you know, 99% of our population is within 100 miles of the border. So, you know, if you're talking about a market, from a market perspective, it's mostly penetrated, you know, in 100 miles within the Canadian border, the edge of the U.S. border between Canada and the U.S. You know, the U.S. is slightly different. It's a bit more like a patchwork, you know. So, but the thing is, are we going to ever have ubiquitous connectivity? Absolutely. By when? 5 years? Maybe 10? I think more like 5, or at least, you know, where it matters the most. And then beyond that, who's to say? I mean, there's a next generation Wi-Fi technology coming up. We should see some early stuff this year called Super Wi-Fi. And that has massive, massive connectivity and massive, massive range. So, you know, maybe that'll fill in the holes. Who's to say, right? But the connectivity solutions, wireless, are coming. And it will not be long before we think, you know, wait a second, that sheep over there has Wi-Fi. You know, it is going to happen.
Yeah, I sure hope so. You know, I envy, you know, we always talk about South Korea as the as example of what everybody else ought to be able to do. And people whine about the United States is nowhere near as good as South Korea. But I saw the guy that actually instituted that in Korea was talking at All Things D one year. And he said, you got to understand, we're very small and very tall. It's really easy to wire that. You know, you have Montana. You know, 4 people live there, but those 4 people care whether you're wired there. And how do you get the coverage to an area like that? And the problem is just so dramatically different.
Yeah, absolutely. To wide open spaces. I mean, South Korea is about the size of half of California. I think South and North Korea, you know, packed in, put them into California, right?
Yeah.
And that's without the mountain. Well, they have mountainous areas, but really, it's, you know, massive population packed into a tiny little space. I mean, you know, if you want to look at what Wi-Fi connectivity, you know, sort of ubiquitous connectivity looks like, look to Europe. Those are the guys that are going to start to show us how it's done. You know, you've got lots and very, very limited ability to run cabling because of, you know, an older infrastructure. So they're going fully Wi-Fi. They're packed in nice and tight. So, I mean, you know, Europe next year will kind of start to look like the way it should be.
I hope so. But what I'd be worried about is that they've got so many different rules because you're changing borders of countries. You know, a lot of stuff's real easy. Now, when you fly into Europe, you can switch countries as long as you're in the European Union. You don't have to show your passport. There's no trouble. There's no border connection. You just fly right back and forth. But your cell phone bill just went up $300 a month because you stepped across this line. And
yeah, true enough, roaming is a bit of a headache. You know?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. And you know, we used to worry about roaming here, but now I can go from L.A. to Boston and never change carriers across 3,000 miles, you know, and you go across, you know, Belgium's, you know, what is it, 20 square miles, something like that, you know, and you hit another, all of a sudden you're paying more money because you cross the border into Holland or something.
Yeah, yeah.
So well, I hope they do it in a way that you don't have to worry about that, or that becomes a problem. You find everybody shutting their phones off because they stepped across the border.
But I think you're seeing that already. The market forces will drive that. I mean, once upon a time, if you're a Canadian, you came to the U.S., you know, you walk home with a $500 or $1,000, you know, cell bill just because you happen to dare go into the U.S. and turn your phone on, right? You know, these days, the impact on my bill, if I could travel to the U.S. for two weekends a month, which I often do, you know, my bill goes up from $100 a month up to $300, so it doesn't go up to $500 or $1,000 anymore. So market forces are driving it, you know, and as the technology becomes more ubiquitous and, you know, the alliances and the technology become more seamless and, you know, affordable, I think the market's going to drive it. Is there still opportunity to get ripped off? Absolutely, but not so much, and it's diminishing over time. We'll figure it out, I think.
Yeah, I hope they don't stay greedy. You know,
well, they can. Eventually, there'll be enough solutions that, you know, there won't be any space for being greedy anymore.
I dream of that world. All right, well, I want to make sure we don't close out without asking about one of the things I love about Lab Rats is when you and Sean do food-related explanations. Again, your tagline is technology demystified. Yeah. I've talked before on the show about my favorite episode, I think was the one where you used Brussels sprouts to explain, what was it, data packets?
Yeah, data packets. Yeah, we're flinging those things around like they're data packets. Absolutely. It's a while back. My favorite one, which we did recently, you know, was on electronic ink, you know, the technology that allows you that runs on the Kindle, electronic books, stuff like that, the Nook.
Right.
That, not the Nook's actually color LCD, but, you know, the Kindle and the those kinds of things. We use milk. So, of course, the way those things work is there's a package of imagine a ping pong ball that's transparent, full of milk, right? And in it are like chocolate sprinkles. And when you run a charge between, you know, in this milk, the sprinkles are float to the top and make a little cluster, looks like a black pixel. Or when you reverse the charge, they sink to the bottom of the milk, and it just looks like white. So we did this with we painted eggs, I think it was, and we heated the water in it like that. You know, eggs of course float when they're baked or whatever, when they're boiled. So that was a lot of fun. You know, we just love doing that, right? It's a great visual way of actually seeing how something works. You know, is it always perfect analogy? No. You know, we have fun doing it, and people, you know, love it. I actually got an email from a guy at a fire station one time, and you know, he was talking to me about you know, years ago I did a thing on transistors, how a transistor works using cheese and tomato sauce. And you know, he said, you know, I explained the theory of transistor by building my own cheese tomato sauce transistor for the ladies in the office. And I just get a great giggle imagining people out there going, you know, let me show you how this works. Give me your cheese, give me your tomato sauce, and let me show you how it works.
I like that. My other favorite was when you explained VPN tunneling by putting peanut butter all over your arm and sticking it in a box full of kittens.
Yeah, that was my cats, Biff and Boo. Yeah, that was back when they were, like, first born. So, yeah that's awesome, right? So VPN, of course, a technology whereby you get protected by kind of a safe wrapper of electronic, you know, encryption as you pass stuff across the internet. So, yeah, you're right. So we put chicken wire as the protection instead of, you know, encryption.
I think you put your arm through a plexiglass tube. So first you had your hand went through a plexiglass box that had the kittens in it, and the kittens were licking your arm, but then you put a plexiglass tube in, and so you were tunneling. So it was the VPN tunneling with that.
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly
But it's so vivid. I think I would use that as a way to explain to somebody how VPN tunneling works. I mean, it's a great visual aid and worked great.
Exactly, except that, of course, the kittens like to bite, so that's the problem.
Got away with all these bite marks at the end. That's good stuff.
That's right, yeah. That was Leo Laporte, actually, who suffered that bite. Anyway, it was hilarious.
Yeah, as long as it wasn't you, right?
Exactly.
All right.
I execute on the plan, and other people get the end of it. So
there you go. Well, Andy, I really, really appreciate you taking the time, especially since you're still unpacking your house from having moved and doing all the traveling that you do. I appreciate you taking the time out to talk to us. You want to wind us up with some plugs to tell people how they can watch your stuff?
That'd be great. Yeah. So our the show that Sean and I do is called Lab Rats. You can get at it at butterscotch.com/labrats. Butterscotch.com, of course, is the parent. We have 4,400 pieces of video that explain everything from Twitter to how to reformat and reinstall Windows, all kinds of mobile stuff to, get to that at butterscotch.com. And, of course, the old grand old lady of the Internet, which I also run, is a world-famous file download site called Two Cows at twocows.com.
All right. Thanks a lot for coming on the show. And it was Sean's loss that he didn't get to come.
He's such a ding-dong. He's like, I'm busier, blah, blah, blah. Poor baby. You should have been on here with me. Oh, well, I get all the glory.
There you go. All right. Thanks a lot, Andy.
Thanks, Allison.
Well, I do still miss Bart terribly, but I do like that we've gotten such interesting and varied guests over the last few months, and Andy was no exception. I had no idea he had his fingers in so many pots these days. I was really impressed. Well, the good news is he's just as silly as he always was, though, so that was a relief. By the way, I did send a tweet to Amber MacArthur asking her to go smack him for all the tech geek moms out there. That's going to have to do us for this week. Many thanks to our sponsors for helping to pay the bills, ScreenStep, Smile, and of course, Honda Bob. Don't forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions by emailing them to me at allison@podfeet.com. Be sure to follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. If you want to join in the fun of the live show, just head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time. And don't forget to sign up for the NoSillaCast news right over on the website. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.